Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we are discussing about digital tax and global corporate tax together with our experts, Rebecca Christis and Nicolas Poitier. Hi, Rebecca. Hi, Nicolas. How are you?
Glad to be here.
Hi. Glad to be here, too.
This is a live recording session taking place on the Sound of Economics Club on Clubhouse. And as usual, for our live recordings, we will have a contribution from some of our listeners who have connected to join us in this conversation. But back to the topic. We've heard in the news during these weeks that the Biden administration has proposed a global corporate tax rate of at least 15% in international talks at the OECD. Let's make a step back and look at the wider issue. Recent rapid and expansive digital transformation has had deep economic and societal impacts, resulting in significant changes. These have sparked global debates in many legal and regulatory realms, and international tax is no different. The tax implications are wide-ranging, affecting both direct and indirect taxation, broader tax policy issues, and tax administration. At the center of the debate is whether international income tax rules developed in a brick-and-mortar economic environment more than a century ago remain fit for purpose in the modern global economy. The fundamental elements of the global tax systems, which determine where taxes should be paid and what portion of profits should be taxed, have served their purpose well. Namely, they have enshrined tax certainty and helped to eliminate double taxation stimulating global trade. Today, however, digitalization poses serious challenges to elements of the foundations of the global tax system. Rebecca, could you explain us the process to revise the system so far, and where do we stand in this process?
The OECD is now coordinating a 139-nation set of negotiations to come up with new rules of the road for corporate taxation. It has two broad strategies, cleverly named Pillar 1 and Pillar 2. Pillar 1 was originally designed as a digital economy tax, but may be being recast as a tax on the biggest companies to make sure that they're paying enough taxes on their profits and that they're paying them in the right places. And then Pillar 2 is the global minimum tax level. And this is very exciting because the Biden administration has totally jump-started these talks. The prior U.S. administration under President Trump not only didn't support them, but actually introduced a provision called Safe Harbor to try and allow the big U.S. companies to just opt out of international tax rules. The Biden administration has thankfully withdrawn that and has gone further of proposing a level of 15% as a globally agreed minimum tax rate for corporate taxes. Countries could go higher than that, but in the case of multinational companies going to tax havens that were below, other countries would be able to sort of top up to make sure that they were paying enough taxes on all of their profits around the world.
Thank you, Rebecca, for this overview. But you know, this is the position of the US, more or less so far. What has been the situation with Europe?
Europe has been expecting, until pretty recently, that it would have to go it alone. Politically, there was a lot of support for a digital services tax, a specific tax on tech companies, and frankly, on the American tech companies who were viewed as doing business in Europe and not paying enough taxes where their customers were. There was an EU-wide proposal for a digital services tax in 2018 that didn't go anywhere. Some of the individual countries have put these taxes in place. And there's a digital levy, unspecified, that we're expecting later this year. With the US coming back to the OECD table, it has really rearranged the debate. Europe now, certainly at the central level, is trying to participate constructively in the debates, is trying to make sure that the digital levy doesn't interfere with anything happening at the OECD level, which is why now when the commission talks about it, they'll say, oh, this has nothing to do with Pillar 1 and Pillar 2. Whereas before, there was a sense that Pillar 1 especially would overlap with what the EU was trying to do. Now they're trying to create some separation to make sure that the OECD process can go forward. The EU simultaneously has finally withdrawn the Common Corporate Consolidated Tax Base with the CCCTB, which was its flagship tax initiative for a long time. They have finally accepted that it's not going anywhere. They've said they're going to relaunch it as something with an acronym, an initialism called BFIT. And they are going to bring that out later this year once they see where the OECD is and hopefully build on what has already been agreed at the OECD level.
Maybe to also to build on that, to explain a little bit the problem that we want to solve with this whole tax reforms. So this whole thing dates back to the financial crisis, but I think the problem is probably much older, that for multinational corporates, it has become standard practice now to build their legal structure in such a way that actually their corporate headquarters, where they account for their profits, and countries is very low to zero tax rates. Here, the biggest countries that contribute to this are actually European countries. So we think about tax avoidance, we always think about Switzerland or islands in the Caribbean or anywhere in the Pacific. But actually, it's Ireland, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands, the countries where many big multinationals have their headquarters. And what they do is basically they pretend that all their profits are incurred in these specific locations. And then they have legal structures in these locations, often together with some kind of holding structures in Caribbean islands or maybe the Marshall Islands. They're basically tax havens that allow them not to pay neither taxes in Ireland nor in these specific small countries. And this resulted that many big multinationals basically pay very, very little to no taxes. This has been exacerbated. Bespoke tax deals that governments like Luxembourg and Ireland have done for some of these companies. But basically, this has resulted in them paying very little taxes. And this has been going on for a long time now. And of course, many citizens in the EU, but also in the US and any other countries, feel like this is deeply unfair, that they have to pay income taxes, but the biggest, most profitable companies in the world do not. And here, I think this is the core problem that this OECD initiative wants to solve. The problem with this is, of course, that in the EU itself, tax is still national competencies, and anything we do with tax in the EU has to be voted on by unanimity, and countries like Ireland basically have no incentive of changing their tax structure in such a way that the profits and the taxation would go to other countries. And so far, they could basically shield themselves or stand behind the US and say, okay, let's do it at the OECD level. And there they knew the US would block it under Trump. And I think this is what really has changed now with the new administration, that with the US re-entering these talks and opening the road for an OECD, countries like Ireland cannot really hide behind the US anymore.
Maybe let's zoom in a little bit more, Rebecca, on the US strategy. I mean, to understand it a bit better, because this is the Biden moves at the global level is coupled also with some moves domestically as well when it comes to corporate taxation and an overall thinking behind. At least this is what it seems to me. Perhaps we can explain this a little bit better to our listeners.
Yeah. Well, as you probably know, the US is in the middle of a massive push to start spending a lot more on infrastructure, on help for families, and on economic recovery from the pandemic in general. Because there are Democrats in charge right now, and because the US budget deficit is already so high, there's an effort to raise taxes to pay for some of this. Now, where should they raise the taxes? Perhaps from companies. This is particularly evident because one of the things the Trump administration did was pass possibly the biggest corporate tax cut in recent history, if not all of American history. They really slashed taxes for these big companies. And then added, sort of as a soupçon of constructiveness, something with the acronym GILTI, which was a 10.5% minimum tax for companies to pay. So we'll give you this huge tax cut, but also we're going to start looking into your different tax shelters and structures around the world and make you pay something. What the Biden administration is proposing is raising the minimum tax rate from 10.5% to 21%, looking at a general 28% corporate tax rate, and also really constructively re-engaging at the OECD level. Now, the OECD level is partly about getting a minimum tax rate. And again, 15 is the international number they're working with. But it's also partly about pushing back against what the US sees as a really targeted effort to go after its big tech companies. The US tech industry has been a place of a lot of innovation, a place of a lot of growth. The feeling in Washington is that Europe both doesn't want to create the conditions for similar innovation in Europe because of the different capital markets and regulatory and funding structures in Europe, but also wants to get mad at the US for the way it's doing business. Back in the bad old days of 6 months ago, the US even had opened trade complaints against France, against Spain and Italy and Austria for these digital services taxes, which they thought were going after the US, singling out the US tech companies.
Wait a second, Rebecca, because this, I think, it's a very fundamental step in the sense that by promoting a global taxation, they are trying to avoid the situation that has been going on in the past few years, where there was single countries taxing US companies in different levels and so on. So there is maybe a global calculation that in the end of the day, this wouldn't be such a bad deal for US companies after all.
The big US companies can afford it. It's not that much money, any of this stuff. And it would be an advantage to them to have common rules of the road and not have to do 140 different types of paperwork in 140 jurisdictions. That said, we should note that it's not only Americans who think that the US defense of the tech companies makes sense. You also hear critics in Europe saying, look, this is clearly too protectionist. This is clearly too much of a trade assault on these big American tech companies rather than an effort to really just go after corporate taxation. So for those people, focusing the OECD more on finding and taxing the corporate profits and less on the digital sector actually makes a lot of policy sense.
I would actually agree with this to some extent that the problem often has been discussed under this whole guise of a digital services tax. And of course, digital services are the ones where it's most thorny, both because digital companies are now the largest companies in the world, and also because the legal location where value added occurs in digital services is much more fuzzy than we think about classical manufacturing. But I think it has always been a bit of a misnomer that this is really a digital issue. This is true in almost any sector with multinational companies, from furniture to banking to you name it. Basically, all multinational companies nowadays, or many, many of them, have complex legal tax structures that avoid taxes, and this leads to very low tax rates for many of them. And here it seemed to me always a bit populist for Europe to basically go against big tech in Europe, where at the same time, basically, it's a homemade problem in a way. I mean, the tax havens are European. So I kind of concur with this notion that it has been a little bit maybe not protectionist, but a little bit populist the way it was framed in Europe. But I think the real problem here is also basically the question where taxation occurs. And here, I think here, the first pillar, I think it is, where tax occurs, and which is actually this digital services tax is also really important. And the US has kind of tried not to talk about this in the past, but I think this is as important as the minimum tax. So the problem is, especially with the digital services, that you can basically choose where you want to pay taxes, which, especially in digital services, where there are very few really big players, this means that one country gets all the tax revenue where other countries don't get anything. And this is, of course, a problem. This is a problem in Europe, but this is also potentially a large problem for emerging markets, that if companies decide just to pay taxes the way we do it right now, basically where the legal headquarters of the corporation is and not where the customer sits, in a globalized world, this, of course, has a problem of distribution of taxes. So I think here, the European position and the American position, on one hand, I think a digital services tax just solves half of the problem, but also at the same time, it's very clear to me that we need a redistribution also of tax revenues, not just make sure that they're taxed at all.
There's also a real debate about whether tech companies are really that different. Some people would say that the platform companies, because of this disconnect and where their workers are and where their customer base is and how they generate their information, that these companies really should be treated differently than other companies that make something and sell something in more direct ways. But other people would say that we've been through versions of this before with advertising or with other sorts of intangible industries, and that the platform companies aren't possibly that different and might be able to follow a similar set of rules.
One question to me is this going to impact on global trade. What are the stakes over there? What are the real stakes? And what exactly could change?
So if they do it right, about $100 billion in tax revenue could start going into various government budgets around the world. This isn't piles of money, but it would make a nice dent in the various deficits and sort of public spending gaps that are out there. Also, if everybody works together, you don't have a trade war. That's the joy of a joint deal. If there isn't a deal and everybody starts patching their own piecework things together, you get in a situation where people can start pointing fingers and threatening sanctions, and it just gets messy.
Yeah, this makes sense to me. Nicholas, you wanted to add something on this, especially the consequences for trade?
Yeah, I would say the problem with this is also that we don't, I mean, especially in services, our trade figures have more and more less made sense in kind of an economic sense, because the more we had this kind of profit shifting, the less services trade data reflected the actual trade of services between different countries, and the more reflected basically the tax structure of large multinationals. There's basically, for a country like Ireland, where nowadays, which basically the most largest companies in the world pretend that all their international profits are occurring, the figures of services trade don't make any sense anymore. So if you look at aggregate statistics for Ireland, often what you read there is basically you cannot learn that much about the Irish economic structure, the more you learn actually about the legal structure of multinationals. So in that way, statistically, just in the trade statistic, it will make a massive difference, because basically we see a reshuffling of flows of basically balance of payment flows. But this is more or less an accounting exercise. In terms of the real economy, I think this, as Rebecca was saying, this could have a positive impact in the way it might make it easier, more transparent for companies to trade. It might also put smaller companies on a more equal footing to larger companies. The large corporations would lose out some of the advantages they can have for having basically a very sophisticated tax structure, whereas which smaller companies might not be able to set up in a similar way. But I think in general, we don't talk here about massive sums. I think this is really more of a regulatory issue. I would expect there to be a massive impact on GDP growth, trade, or in services or anything like this.
I might ask a question that might be, you know, very far off, or like that has nothing to do with the debate, but I haven't heard in this conversation anything about China. We've been hearing about the US stance, we've been hearing about different Europe variegated positions around the digital taxes and so on, but I haven't heard anything about the position of China. Is there anything out there?
So I must admit, I don't know to which extent China engaged in this OECD talk.
Yeah, exactly. I'm wondering if they are at all involved.
Yeah, but what I would like to say here is basically China is not very big in services trade. Especially if you think about digital services, China doesn't allow foreign digital services companies to operate in China or the big platform corporations. And in a similar way, it's the kind of state control that the government has over data has made it difficult for some of these corporations to operate abroad. At the same time, there are controls on capital flows and so on outside of China, which makes China a very peculiar case or a very different case than we think about services trade and this kind of capital flows that are used to build up these legal structures than if we think about something like US and Europe. So China is really an outlier in this way, or maybe not an outlier, but it's very different than the large Western economies.
Yeah, China is a participant in the OECD inclusive format. Again, 139 countries. That includes every European country, EU country, except for Cyprus. You don't hear a lot about tax cheating for Chinese companies. You hear about state control, you hear about regulation, you hear about all kinds of things, but taxes don't really come up. In the Asian context, people mostly talk a little bit about Hong Kong, they talk about Singapore, and they talk about some of the other international financial hubs, but not so much mainland China.
Okay, that's kind of interesting, you know. But as Nicholas said, reflects also the composition of the economy and the composition of the flow of services. In the meantime, I see that Robert joined us on stage. So, Robert, would you like to ask the question?
I just want a simple question, because for me, I was kind of surprised by that there's no discussion about what this movement towards a minimum tax portends in the ability for countries to raise taxes. Because I just see this as it's suddenly come to the fore because the United States wants to raise taxes, and they want to kind of trap, they don't want it leaking out if they do raise taxes significantly higher. I mean, there's no point in doing this exercise if you don't think you're going to raise taxes, right?
So there's a little bit of that going on, but you also have just the question of fair taxation. When you talk about base erosion and profit shifting, which is the long-time thing, base erosion means companies making their profits look smaller than they really are to pay fewer taxes. And profit shifting means moving your reported profits to a place with a very low tax rate from a place that's a high tax rate. So it's different ways of legally fixing your books. Nicholas said earlier that there's a regulatory element here, and that's true. There is a real effort to make sure that people are playing by the rules, that they're competing fairly, and that companies with more lawyers and more accountants aren't getting an unfair leg up on smaller companies that don't have these things. In terms of raising money, we're not talking about that much money here, but we are talking about fixing the system and making it work better and more fit for purpose for the years to come.
Thank you, Rebecca. And now I would like to ask Nicholas for any final remarks so that we go towards the end of this episode.
Yeah, maybe to step back and look a little bit at the bigger picture. I think this is one of the areas where we've really seen a re-engagement of the US and in a considerable shift from the position we had under Trump and basically a shift towards a European position. And I think we should be happy now the US claims to be at the forefront and driving the agenda. One can debate if that's true or not, or if they just basically shifted to the position the EU has held for a longer time. But I think the important point is that here an issue where there has been really, it has been a stalemate for quite a while, we see a considerable shift. And I think that is something that made me very optimistic. As Rebecca said, it's to be seen now if basically when we will get this actually, there's a question mark. But now the US government has taken over ownership of this. And I think there is now a political momentum that will hopefully drive this to conclusion sometime. Let's hope maybe this summer or over the next years in this administration. So I think there's a good reason to be optimistic about this. And as Rebecca said, we don't talk about massive taxes. I'm not sure if this will make any significant difference in paying for the Corona recovery funds or anything like that. But this issue has always been something where many people felt it's deeply unfair and where it's been a political contentious issue. And that we now basically see here a new EU-US push to resolve this, I think, is one of the areas where I feel like transatlanticism might have returned to a better outcome. So I think this is one area which made me quite optimistic.
Thank you, Nicholas. Rebecca, some final thoughts?
It would be great if this led us to a new victory for transatlantic cooperation. The downside risk is that the fragmentations within Europe end up weakening the global consensus because Europe is not agreed on all of this. Some European countries really just want to keep the minimum tax rate to 12.5% as opposed to 15% or some other number. Others are really focused on keeping their digital services taxes or following through on political promises they made to tax the digital economy. If the European infighting translates into a general sense that we can't let the Americans win on this, there could be a bad outcome. On the other hand, if people are willing to accept that some deal is better than no deal, there could be a really good base for building even more on top of that.
Thank you, Rebecca. And do you think it's realistic to have a deal? I mean, we heard that Commissioner Gentiloni has been quite optimistic. And then since the Biden administration announced that 15% would be acceptable rate for them, it seems that we are slowly, but we are kind of moving towards some sort of common ground. That's my impression.
I think it's possible, which is really a lot different from where we were 6 months ago.
So on this positive note, we will end up this episode, but of course we are keeping monitoring this debate, and Rebecca has a blog post on our website, www.bruegel.org, which you can read and which will explain all these intricacies of this topic. I would also like to remind you that our podcast has a club on Clubhouse with the same name, and I invite you to follow us and participate to our conversation there. So thank you a lot for joining The Sound of Economics. Thanks, Rebecca. Thanks, Nicholas.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And until next time, bye-bye.